Hello and welcome to the Business of Authority. I'm Jonathan Stark.
And I'm Rochelle Moulton.
And today we're going to talk about the pros and cons of instituting an application process.
Versus just selling it off your site or having a call ahead of time, yes?
Or even a wait list.
Good point.
Yeah. So, yeah. But yes, imagine on your website, you've got different calls to action like, I don't know, buy now or add your name to the waiting list. This mm-hmm. this would be essentially deciding to put a call to action on your website that says apply now.
Mm-hmm.
And the implications around doing such a thing are very interesting. I find them very interesting, but there's pros and cons for sure. I just went through this for a new thing I'm working on, and the psychology is very different, but it was also, for me, it was a lot of herding cats. It had that herding cats feeling where I was like, I got to really pay attention to this or I'm going to screw something up. So let's talk about where you have used this in your business. Maybe start there.
So the application process, I've used that on my mastermind. I've also used it intermittently on my one-to-one coaching. And I liked using it there because it kind of kept the riffraff off. And all I mean by the riffraff is people who really weren't serious or who couldn't afford it and just really wanted to have a conversation with me.
Right.
And there are other avenues to do that. But yeah, and on the mastermind, it's absolutely essential because there's an income requirement. Oh, let me also add, there is an application, a very simplified application process for my Soulless Women community. That one also has an application process.
Cool. Okay. So why do you say that it's absolutely essential for the mastermind one?
Well, because I need to know that they're eligible. And so I ask, trying to remember how many questions there are. I think there's like 10 in total, but that includes like your name, the kinds of things you sell. But yeah, I want to see, are they selling consulting services? Are they selling B2B versus B2C? I really want to know what their revenue was last year and what their target is for the current year. And that has different weights depending on whether it's January, you know, September or December.
Okay, perfect. And the mastermind, I'm assuming, but let's just make sure that that's got a hard cap on the number of seats.
It does.
Okay, yep. So it's wild because before we pressed record on this one, it wasn't obvious to me, but now it is that the type of application that I just did an application process with a cap number of seats is a different kind of application than the other ones you listed, which I have also used in the past. So like my sort of anti-tire kicker application for private coaching is similar to what you just described,
mm-hmm.
where it's like, you know, someone who's not serious isn't going to go through this process and tell me all of answer this big long list of questions that need to be answered thoughtfully and are very revealing and require a certain level of humility and vulnerability, perhaps.
Yeah, so, there's an intimacy with that. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, they're telling me secrets. So they're not going to do that if they're not serious. And so for me, that sort of thing is more of a qualification step for, well, I guess, yeah, it's similar because it could disqualify them. But I found that for the thing that I just did, since it wasn't, it was much more high volume. So let me explain that. So the private coaching thing could turn into this, but it doesn't generally because there is a cap to the number of private coaching students I'll take at any one time.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not, it's priced such that there's very low demand. So when someone bubbles up to that price point, they are, it's not super common. Like I don't want a lot of those students. I can't handle a lot of those students.
Mm-hmm.
So even getting one or two new ones of those a year is plenty. So I don't have a situation where I never have a situation where too many people have applied for the remaining spot. That's the distinction.
Okay.
I might meet with someone and say no and reject the application, but I don't then move it to the next person in the list. It's like I pretty much only ever have one active application at a time for that. So that there's very little to me in terms of there's very little required organizationally of me to handle that. Because it's kind of like it feels like they just sent me a very, very detailed email. And then
exactly.
I can just decide whether or not to set up a phone call with them. And if so, then maybe it's just a normal sales process.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just this speed bump. to filter out people that aren't really ready. Now, this other thing I'm talking about is more similar to your mastermind, where there is a hard cap on the number of people that you can accept. There's a deadline, mm-hmm. and you get more applicants than you can accept. And I found that to be that overwhelmed my current, didn't completely overwhelm, but it did exceed the capacity of my current systems, because I just never do anything like that. So I really had to like pull out a spreadsheet, color code it, track, you know, I basically created an ad hoc CRM for like one workshop.
And what was the cap? The, how many people?
20.
Okay.
So there's all these micro deadlines that happen. Mm-hmm. So like the thing was going to be on a date. So then I let people know about it. So then I accepted applications for 20 seats. I took the form down when I had 28 applications, you know, like that was even maybe more than I wasn't sure what the conversion rate was going to be, but I was like, I think I should shut it down now, because they were looking pretty good. Like it felt like a lot of almost everybody who applied looked at first glance like they would qualify. So I was like, okay. So then you shut that off. And then you get all these emails like, oh, am I too late? And you have to all this correspondence. Yes, you're too late. And then, you know, you review the applications, which is fairly time consuming, to be honest.
How many questions roughly?
10.
Okay.
And they're similar to ones you listed, but the trying to think what the 10 questions, but I also had to go through these steps. Like one of the things was it's a workshop about improving your website, making it actually work instead of not work. So reviewing their website was one thing, and I had to, you know, it didn't take long, but it was like a very non-automatable kind of process where I'd, you know, click on the link, poke around, mm-hmm. Get a sense for how sophisticated or unsophisticated it felt like they might be currently, try and get a sense of, based on their website, do they essentially appear to know everything I'm going to teach kind of thing?
Oh, okay. Yeah. How much do they need you?
Right. Are they too advanced? Are they mm-hmm. too basic? How long have they been in? There's a lot of questions I could just read, like how long have you been in business, blah, blah, blah. That's easy. Mm-hmm. But then the other thing was I wanted to know, this was time consuming too. I'd take their email and go through is the closest thing I have to a CRM, which is my email inbox, and search to see if they had been in any of my other workshops before, if they had corresponded with me at length in the past. You know, I don't have a CRM, okay. So this is the closest thing I had. So that felt very messy, but it was just inefficient.
You're not used to doing that.
No, I never do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's these deadlines like, okay, I gotta send out applications to the ones that are accepted. I send out rejections to the ones that are definitely not a good fit. And then I have to give a time limit on the acceptances so that you fill up the 20 spots before the thing happens. Right.
How do they pay? So you send them, you're accepted. Do you give them a link to then pay?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
But I can't wait for them to pay it, maybe pay the Thursday night before the Friday workshop.
Right.
I want to know who's in or who's not. So it's like, right. So you've got mm-hmm. a deadline on the payment for each individual person.
Yeah.
And even then, you know, the conversion rate was astronomically high on this group of people, but it's not 100%.
Never is.
Right. So you're like,
almost never.
Yeah. So it was just a lot of moving parts, and I'm still in the middle of it. Like, and so at the same time, now I have to be sending out information about here's how to prepare, here's where it's going to be, here's how long it's going to take, here are the more details that I promised. And who did I send that to? Because I'm only sending it to the people that paid, which is mm-hmm. a subset of the whole list of people who I accepted.
Do you pay through MoonClerk?
Yeah.
Okay. So you could trigger an automatic message and ConvertKit so you didn't have to worry about it.
Yes, that is true. But I am not... This is a one-time only thing. I'm not going to run it again. And it's going to be extremely hands-on half-day workshop with 20 people, which will turn into one of my five-day challenges that isn't like hands-on workshop with me specifically. It's more like a video course. So yes, I could do that. There are a whole bunch of things I could have done to make this easier, but it seemed like, well, this is a prototype, so I'm not going to create those systems.
Oh, yeah. For 20 people, I would have created it. I would have done it just because the cognitive load of trying to figure out if I sent it to somebody or not.
Yeah, it's very high.
I would fall down there somewhere.
So yeah, I probably will.
It's so funny because you're usually the first person to automate, and I'd like step back and think about it a little bit more. But this one, you know, having done enough of these, I think I would have automated that. Plus, you're going to take 20 people. If it was a, you know, if it's a group of 10, maybe not. Although I still automate those because it's a recurring. But once you start to get to 20, it starts to feel unwieldy.
I agree. I had done it before, I might have taken the extra step to do that. But at the same time, I'm actually not the first person to automate something. I only automate it when it's becoming repetitive. So then I know what to automate. But if I was going to do this again, see, I could have announced this to my mailing list and gotten no response. So I wouldn't have wanted to set up all this automation in advance and then nobody shows up. So I wanted to do something that was as low effort as possible up front to test the idea. Turned out the idea was viable. And then I found myself in the situation where I was like, it would have been nice.
Well, I wouldn't have done it ahead of time, though. No, I agree with your rationale. I'm just saying, once you knew that you had enough people and you had to sort to get to 20, that's the point I would have automated. But anyway, that's just kind of a side note.
That's good advice for a listener, though, because that would have made it a lot easier if I had just done that one bit. It honestly didn't occur to me.
Yeah. But if it were 10 or fewer, it might not be worth it for a one-time thing. Recurring, it almost always is worth it, if only make sure you're not manually checking things off a list because we're going to miss things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. No doubt. Like if I was going to do this again, perhaps, I mean, I have like a sort of a checklist that I've been building just to like keep myself, my head from exploding. But I'm not going to do this workshop again, but I might do an experiment or a test like this again, in which case, yeah, there are two things that I thought about doing that I didn't do. One was when I sent out the acceptances with the link to buy, I could have made those links expiring so that, you know, this link's going to expire in 24 hours. So I don't have to manually check, you know what I mean? And then the other thing is the follow-up information once they do pay. Right. So, because now what I want to do, which I can't, what I would like to do is wait until I'm positive that everybody that is going to pay has paid and then send one email to everybody. But that's, you know, I want to let people who already paid know as soon as possible so they can plan and so forth. What the details, set their expectations, start to warm them up, all of those things. And I can't do that if I wait until the last minute, say, okay, everybody, tomorrow's the workshop. Here's the information. So yeah, that would have been a really smart thing to do.
What we're saying is having an application process, depending on what it is that the process applies to, can create a new level of complexity that you're not used to handling.
Yes, but what's the flip side?
Yeah, let's hear that.
The flip side is fantastic. And I actually breezed right by it, but the conversion rate is insane. So like normally if I launch something to my list, Even to people on a waiting list. So, you know, let's say people are interested in taking 5-day podcast challenge. It's not opening for a couple of months. There's a place where they can put in their email address and get notified when registration opens. That, you know, if I end up with 500 people on the list, the conversion rate from that group, when I let them know that it's open, I mean, 50% would be really good. It's never 50%, but it might be like 10%.
No, still, compared to 1 or 2% traditionally, that's pretty good.
It's pretty good, right? Yeah. So these people raised their hand. They said, yes, I'm interested. Keep me in the loop. And so they have a higher likelihood of buying. And then once that group gets that message, then I announce it to the main list. And like you said, the conversion rate is like 1 or 2%. So low conversion rate. But with this application process, where would I say the conversion rate is? I guess if we say the conversion rate on the purchase, it's like 85%. Like I got 28 applications. I rejected 3. And then so of the 25 remaining, I'll fill the 20 spots.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even fair. Like the conversion is probably higher than 85%. I can't do the math in my head, but.
But so wait a minute. So with the 25 people, is it whoever pays first gets the 20 spots? Is that how you decide?
Basically, I didn't. So it sort of sent out the acceptances in waves. So there was like a first wave and then those people paid and then next wave, you know, it was like, because I didn't know what the conversion rate was going to be. So
right,
it's like, so when I sent out the first 10, And like nine of them immediately paid. I was like, okay, this is going to sell out for sure. But now I've got whatever, 15 people for 10 spots. And only, I think two or three I rejected just totally out of hand. Like one of them was just a brand new business, like 2 months in. And I wanted people that had 5 years or so or more.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's just created this, it's like I lit a fuse and now I'm like racing around before the bomb goes off to get all of the ducks in a row and have like a reasonably good experience. I mean, I told the people, I'm like, this is a prototype thing. It's not, you know, not a test. It's going to be good, but it was a little bit of a weather balloon. And it's also a little bit of like, you know, you get first crack at this content in a very high interaction setting that will never exist again. The combination of hard deadline, this is going to be on Friday, March 8th, this Friday, as we're recording. And so a hard deadline, hard maximum number of seats.
Scarcity.
Like double scarcity. And then going through an application process where it's got that disqualification feel of the application forms we talked about before. So when you stack those three things, and then I can legitimately, honestly say to people, look, click this button and check out in the next 24 hours, or the seat is going to go to the next person in line who really wants it.
Yeah.
The psychology of what's happening with the buyers, which is all legitimate. It's not fake. None of it's fake. It's all actual. And I'm just letting them know the situation to keep their expectations appropriate. What does it result in? It results in an insane conversion rate. So definitely worth the effort. But you're right. I think two, if I just did a little tiny bit of automation on the links that I sent out so that they expired. And then mm-hmm. once somebody checked out, they got all the information that they needed to join, which is the way I have it set up for my regular workshops.
Yeah, right. But you were thinking this is just a one-time thing, so why bother? But I think the rule of thumb I would use is if you've got more than 10 people that you're juggling for this kind of thing, especially where, you know, you're trying to figure out where to draw the cutoff line, you probably want to use a little automation once you've got 10 or more.
Lesson learned. I totally agree. Yeah. That's good advice.
Yeah. But the other thing, though, just as an observation, is the challenge that you had with this would not be the same challenge that someone who normally sells projects directly to clients would have, because they have a CRM system. They are tracking, hopefully. I said that and realized it's not always the case. But what I'm talking about are, you know, high-end B2B consultants where you've got a niche. You have, and the CRM could be a piece of paper or an Excel spreadsheet. I mean, it doesn't mean you have to buy, you know, Salesforce or Pipedrive, but you've got a way of tracking those people. And so a lot of the annoyances that you experience would not be the same for someone who customarily operated their business with one-to-one client relationships.
Right. Yeah. I never had this kind of problem, or not problem. I never had this situation with, like when I was doing project work, value price project work, or product value services, because there was just never, other than 1 year when I really did a strong push into one-on-one coaching, I never had to track any of it because it was all just obviously in my mind. You know, it was like at a certain threshold. And like you said, it's right around 10, but at a certain point, your brain just can't keep all of it top of mind.
Dunbar's number.
Right. Well, I wish I could get close to that.
I don't know about you. I can't get to it. I think it's 144. I can't keep that in my brain anymore with detail. I can recognize their faces and their names, but not, you know, my brain just doesn't automatically go, oh, yes, we met in 2004 and we did these five things. Yeah, I need to keep that in a place that's other than my short-term memory.
Right, right. Well, let's loop back to, so I think we had three different sort of scenarios where an application process has come into play in our businesses. So for the listener, let's say they are doing, you know, B2B consulting engagements. What is the thing that they would want to start to sell that would be the right fit for some kind of an application process?
Advisory, for sure. Because kind of for the same reason, I like the way you walk through your process for your one-to-one coaching. It's like the person filling out the application has to show a certain amount of vulnerability in order to do it. So it keeps the looky-loos away. and it's very focused on, you know, your people. I think that works really well. The other place it works is if you're doing some kind of a group program for the first time. And usually these folks are not doing group programs because it starts to feel more B2C, a little bit more rare, but that would be a place for an application. So let's say that I work with CFOs. Those are my clients, and CFOs at big Fortune 500 companies, and I want to create some kind of a community for them. Then I would have an application process. I would want that they had to be in their job for 2 years, let's say, or their company had to be on the Fortune 500 list, or it had to be on the Fortune 1000, or it had to be in this industry. So then I would use one. Absolutely.
Yep, that's a great example. Mastermind, you know, I guess I think a mastermind is I'm picturing it as something different, but you know, as you already gave the example of a mastermind, that seems like a no brainer. So masterminds, communities, I have a non-trivial amount of people in my world who are doing educational workshop type things that do feel kind of B2C, but I have a lot of people that have courses of one kind or another.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I can think of one where in fact, this is pre-COVID, but I don't know what he's doing now, but his workshops were all in-person workshops, and he would, and it was like maybe $1,200 a seat, and he would fly to the market, and he would, you know, he'd find the place in the market, fly to wherever, San Francisco, and do the thing. You know, and if he got like 20 people, it's like $20,000, $25,000 of raw revenue that then he could use to finance the whole thing. So knowing in advance, you know, because you got to make it, this is it's a good example because you have to make a lot of decisions where there's going to be, you know, plane tickets or room rental or there's all these upfront costs that are way, way more serious than me not wanting to create, you know, spend 15 minutes creating two automations that would have saved me a lot of headaches, you know, talking about thousands of dollars to find out that, oh, no one signed up.
Yeah.
So, right. So
like doing a conference, like a mini version of a conference.
Yeah, exactly. It's very much like that. It's like a little mini one day conference with one talk. So that's any kind of like, what would you call that? Like, even if it was online, whether or not it's in person or online, I think it just changes your upfront costs or your costs. But I mean,
I'd probably call it a conference, even though it's not exactly, but that idea.
Yeah.
Or a meeting. I mean, you could call it a meeting, but it's the same, you know, it's a day.
Mm-hmm. I guess there's two things here. I was about to say that I would generally only go through the trouble of having this process if it was a paid thing. So it was going to generate revenue, but that's not 100% true. I can imagine situations where I'm
doing one that's not paid. And some people would tell me I'm absolutely insane for doing it, but I did it anyway. Yeah. So the Soulless Women community, I mean, it's unpaid. They have an application process. It's really simple questions. I think there are 7 questions. But then I meet with everyone who has an application that I approve. And again, total bottleneck. I am 100% the bottleneck. And that was done with complete intention because I wanted to carve out how this group would operate. And I wanted people at varying revenue levels who I knew were serious about building their business. I didn't want, you know, dilettantes.
Great
point.
Not
a place for dilettantes.
Right. So it can be used as a quality control mechanism, which is really cool. The way that it functioned for me leading up to this particular thing was that it allowed me to test the market in it's a very cheap experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And with, you know, my friend who does these sort of flies around to do these one day open to the public workshops, it's a cost control thing. So for me, it's also a cost control thing. I'm trying to keep the experiment as low price as possible. Same for him. Yours is a different example and a good one, which is that you're controlling the quality, or you're trying to control the quality of the experience for the community, which is really good. And I was thinking, you know, I interviewed a guy one time who did something that I know I will do someday, which is when you find yourself in a market, meaning you're traveling, you're out of town, you're in some other town, probably a big city, and you just put out the word like, hey, I'm at going to be at this place tonight. If you want to meet up, I'll be there.
Mm-hmm.
And so this guy did, this guy ended up starting a community by accident that way, by saying, oh, I'm going to be upstairs at the, you know, Thinking Man's Tavern at 9 on Friday. Anybody wants to come by and talk about whatever, mobile apps, come by. And he had 50 people show up or something. It's just like, whoa, this is interesting.
Cool. Right.
But in theory, something like that, you could have an application process for that sort of velvet rope kind of thing for it. And what the pros of the application process, if there is actual demand, if there's enough demand for it, I think the psychology of it is extremely beneficial for both parties. Because on the one hand, it decreases your risk and level of effort for the person who's posting the application. And then for the people who want the transformation, it gets them off the fence. Like it sort of forces the issue. It increases the cognitive dissonance between like what they say they want to be and how they're behaving. Right.
Yeah.
And it just like, it really forces the issue. The flip side of it is, this didn't happen to me in this particular case, but I know it happens and it probably will happen to me, is you could find out there's no demand. And yep. Say like, oh, I'm going to have 20 seats. In fact, I almost made it 10 seats because I was like, I don't know if there's going to be 20 people that want this. And I was like, nah, I'm going to go 20. And sure enough, that was probably the right number.
Yeah, you know, sounds like a good decision.
Oh, yeah, I'm glad I did it. I couldn't have handled many more people in the Zoom call. So I didn't want more than 20. But I was like, I was nervous about the kind of like, what would my messaging be? Because what would the message be? Yeah, like, if the experiment failed, and you know, we've talked before, I think off mic, it's like the worst case isn't zero, it's one.
One. One is the worst.
Yeah. Because then you got to tell somebody, you're actually the only person that signed up for this, so I'm going to cancel it or whatever.
Yeah.
So you're placing yourself at a little bit of a risk that you threw a party and no one showed up except for one person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like much more embarrassing in that situation. So you're putting yourself out there. You are putting yourself out there with the application process, because you're really calling attention to the fact that there's a certain number of seats and you want them, you know, you want to be like an Apple store with a line out the door, because then it just attracts a longer line.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that the other piece of this with the whole application process is that it sounds maybe counterintuitive, but you get to know the people better. It's like you understand what they're thinking going in. And it's kind of like, especially for your room of 20, you want to know a fair amount about those people before you put them in the room for this mm-hmm. kind of a thing, because you've got a very specific outcome you've promised them and you have a very specific reason for doing this, which isn't, right. you know, to make X number of dollars from this. It's to figure out, you know, is this viable as a new challenge, and what mm-hmm. are the issues and how do you deliver to multiple people? I actually kind of like that you picked 20 instead of 10, not just because you sold out, but because 20 can be more than two times as hard as 10.
Yeah, you know, I agree with that.
Because typically, you know, groups of 8 to 12 are manageable. When they get bigger than that, you've got to change up your techniques usually to make sure that everybody's getting what they need. So I actually think it's a really good experiment for you for different reasons.
Yeah, I dig it. And so what you were just saying about getting to know the people is a little bit what I was getting at when I said it's kind of like getting paid to do a listening tour, because I know what the material is that I want to share. I know what the problem is and I know everyone has it, but I don't know how they think about it. I don't necessarily know how they talk about it. I know a little bit, but I want to know exactly. Of the people who are willing to write a check to solve this problem, of that subset of all the people who have the problem, what is the way that they are going to articulate the pains, the challenges, the stories they tell themselves around, you know, this one's about, you know, making your website actually bring you leads instead of just sitting there like it's dead. And how do they think about it? How much effort are they willing to put in? All of these things. And the beauty, I guess one of the really cool things about it is getting to know them up front through the application process. I'm going to be able to refine the material leading up to the event and in real time, because I've got so much more information about them in my head. And it's just going to make the ultimate thing, the video version of this that eventually comes out, it's going to make it so much more effective from a marketing standpoint and the delivery standpoint of like what the actual product is, the design of the product, if you want to think of it like that.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that does for you if you do this, but for the listener, is that when you, let's use the example of 20, is that you can look at these applications and figure out how to subdivide the group.
Yep.
For different things. So like, you know, it doesn't have to be one room with 20 people. It might be five rooms with four people or two rooms with 10. And when you start to see just in the application process, doesn't mean that's how it's going to actually unfold in real life as you teach it, but it gives you the ability to start to think about, oh, well, so maybe on this one, it would be better if we had groups of three, which doesn't divide into 20. But if we add you, that's 21. So that works. Or maybe it's, you know, we just want to divide this in half, people who have this problem and people who have this problem.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives you a lot of, I just think, interesting information to make the learning experience more powerful.
Yeah, I can prepare. I wouldn't be able to prepare in the specific. I could prepare in general, but I couldn't prepare in the specific. Right.
Yeah.
So like in general, I could say like, oh, best practices or this, that, and the other. But that would be less likely to produce delightful outcomes for the people who actually show up, the specific people who are there. You know, if it was just like, hey, on Friday, you know, show up or don't show up, you know, you can buy right up until the last minute and let yourself in. And then just I'm sort of reacting to the group that appears, that materializes at the last second. It prevents a lot of, it's just worse for everyone. You know, the odds are that it would be worse for everyone, but being able to like have a sense that the people, you know, because there was some people who completely different kind of business. Like I had one person who was like, I mean, this was specifically for like soloists or business owners, like the owner of a one person or a very small headcount company that is capable of editing their own website and or has someone who can do it like at hand, like very easily, and is familiar with Google Docs and, you know, like these different things. So very, very, very specific. But, you know, so if these other people showed up, like someone who never used Google Docs, is someone who just started in business, someone who is running a nonprofit with 1,100 employees, and now I gotta deal with that in real time, and then they're answering their question about, oh, how do I get into Google Docs, or like, oh, how do you do this for a nonprofit with over 1,000? It's like no one else is gonna certainly they're not gonna get as much benefit out of the answer to that question as if everybody was kind of in the same boat.
It's a distraction.
Yeah, right.
An annoyance for you, a distraction for the participants. So yeah, there's a lot to be said for putting up some requirements ahead of time and then using the application process to sort through and figure out your best fits.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I wanted enough diversity, and I mean that in the broadest possible sense. I want enough diversity that people wasn't totally homogenous and that there was like different perspectives. But I also wanted it to be homogenous enough that it acted as a mini kind of pop-up community, in a sense, where people could relate, and the answers to person B's question are helpful to person A.
I mean, that's the classic challenge we all face with our audiences, right? It's we want it to be homogenous in one sense, and we want it to be diverse in another. And so, especially when you offer products and services that people opt into and you're putting some kind of a cohort together, you've got to have a certain amount of homogeny to make it work, or everybody's doing their own thing.
Right. Doesn't gel.
Yeah, it doesn't. And you can, if you talk to people who've gone through sessions like that, you can feel the burn. They're like, oh no, I hated that because, or everybody else was this way, but I was this way. So the material just didn't apply to me. And you can hear the frustration.
Yeah. So funny you should say that part. I forgot. But part of the reason why I set up this application process for this live, you know, half-day workshop was because I just went through a workshop. I had gone through a workshop like a week or two before where they were way too loose in that regard.
Mm.
And they even knew that there were two completely different groups of people in the workshop. They knew it in advance. And yet it was like the worst of both worlds.
Because they didn't divide it.
instead of splitting it up into two different halves of the day or two different sessions and just running it twice, but with, you know, a slightly more advanced one and a less advanced one. Instead of that, they tried to appeal to everybody. And
yeah,
in my opinion, it was like, it was over the heads. A lot of stuff was over the heads of the people who were the new people. And then it was just like completely boring to the more advanced people most of the time.
Yeah.
Right. So it's just,
ouch.
Yeah. So that was, I was trying to avoid that by being very mm-hmm. picky with the application process.
Yeah. I do think, you know, there's not a problem with being picky with application processes as long as you get the numbers that you need to make it viable for you. And, you know, there's two ways to go with that. One is if you can't get the numbers, don't do it. The other is to do what, you know, this other person did, which is mix everybody together and have a big giant mess. So that's the challenge with this is finding that middle ground where you're giving real value to people and you're making it homogenous enough that you can do that.
Right. Yeah. Like, yeah. I wonder if there are people in the audience like objecting to this, but so like, imagine if not everybody spoke English, like not even as a first language, like, I suppose all of my marketing materials were in English. I didn't ask if everybody spoke English. Everybody's website that I reviewed was in English, but it's like, if I had a mix of people who only spoke English and people who only spoke Japanese, that would be a really bad experience for all of them.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that because I had a woman drop out of she applied and then she dropped out before we closed because English was not her first language. Yeah. And she was worried it would just be too fast paced for her.
Right.
And I found her English incredible. I mean, her English is 100 times better than my speaking her native language. But, you know, I bow to that. You know, you've got to know your limits and how much you're willing to push yourself, I guess. Like, how mm-hmm. important is this relative to her ability to converse in English? So totally get that.
Yeah. And actually, that's, I think, a valuable point to make, which is in my challenges, which are asynchronous and aren't this like rapid fire live interactive mm-hmm. type of thing. Those are much more friendly to people for whom English is not. I mean, they're in English, but people can go at their own pace. They can watch the videos at half speed. They can use Google Translate to communicate more clearly or effectively or understandably in Slack. So if I were to institute an application process for one of those, it wouldn't be as important that you had a really good fluency in English. But for a live thing where people are going to be, you know, in breakout rooms and talking to each other and it's not just me talking, then it's a much bigger deal. I didn't actually think to ask that, but I think I based on the applications, I didn't get any red flags like, ooh, this might be
most
tricky
people
for this
self-police on that, because if they're going to spend what to them is a lot of money on a thing, they're going to make sure they can understand it. And there's the other side of that too, which is it's incumbent upon us to not use so much slang. And I'm always surprised at how much slang I use. Like, I'm correcting myself when I'm with people from multiple countries who are speaking English. So many times I like stop and say, all right, how can I say this? Not using this really American expression
right.
that might not translate if you haven't, you know, immersed yourself in the U.S. culture.
Right.
So, yeah, that goes both ways. But most of us have a natural communication style. And if you're selling these kinds of services and products, people know what they can expect from you, whether they can understand you or not.
Right. That's true. Yeah. Okay. So I guess to wrap up the concept, an application process is a very interesting tool that you can use in different ways to produce different kinds of results. And I think what we're saying here is that in a situation where you're doing something, I think it's most important in areas where you're doing something where there's going to be a group. I mean, there are other applications of it, not to overuse the term. There are other other places where you might want to use it, like one-on-one things and so forth. But I think it really shines with group type stuff for both the quality control and being able to deliver high quality to the attendees or whoever the people are, being able to deliver high quality to them, I think it's really helpful. And then from your perspective as the person, you know, the seller in this case, it gives a lot of benefits in terms of predictability to help you control costs, leading up, you know, to not overspend.
Well, yeah. And the other thing is there's a magic when you put people together. And I've used revenue levels a lot of times as a proxy. And what happens is if you're earning $600,000, you don't want to be in a group where everybody else is earning $200,000. You're too much of an outlier. And it's not that you can't get any benefit, but you're not getting the benefit that you wanted. So that's the other thing. Applications really allow you to deliver the experience you most want to the right people.
Exactly. Cool.
Okay.
I think that's a good place to leave it.
Let's do it.
All right, folks. That's it for this week. I'm Jonathan Stark.
And I'm Rochelle Moulton.
And we hope you join us again next time for the Business of Authority. Bye.
Bye-bye.